Raja Tarak speaks again.
After tireless searching, I have claimed my final viraji. Kalinda, arise!
I stand, and one of the brethren brings over a pot of henna. He adds more dye to the faded line down my nose, reaffirming that I am a claimed bride.
The brethren endorse this young woman, says the brother. We pray yours will be a happy union.
Your support is noted, Brother Shan,
Tarak says. Brother Shan returns to his fellow brethren. I trail him out of the corner of my eye, having recognized his name. He is the brother Devon sent the beggar boy to for assistance. The Raja gestures me forward. I scale the half-dozen steps to the foot of his throne. He opens a velvet pouch and removes an ornate turquoise necklace. He holds up the jewelry for all to see.
For my final Rani, I sought the help of the gods to find a young woman who resembled my first wife, Yasmin. I lost Yasmin when we were very young, but her short life changed mine forever. I scoured Tarajan for someone who could match her memory. A few came close, but none exhibited Yasmin's brave spirit and selfless virtues more impressively than Kalinda.
He fastens the necklace around my throat. The stones lie heavy and cold on my collarbone.
The gods teach us that life is a cycle. It is only appropriate that my final wife receive a token of my first wife. And so it is that Yasmin will live on through Kalinda.
Raja Tarak leads me by the elbow to sit in the unoccupied third throne. Angry tears pool in Lakia's eyes. I face his court of Ranis and courtesans, their stares almost as insufferable as his choking necklace. He has set me apart from his women. He may as well have placed a collar on me with a leash tying me to him. Tarek's hand floats down my hair.
The Viraji is the champion of my choosing. But I am a benevolent man. I welcome any courtesan who believes she can best Kalinda to step forward. Let those who wish to duel for her rank cast their lot before us and the gods.
The brethren file out of the throne room, and several women come forward. Natasha beats the others to the front of the line and hands me a square white envelope. At Tarek's nod, I open the envelope and read the card within. I, Natasha, hereby challenge the 100th Viraji to a rank duel.
Viraji, she says, bowing with a smirk.
My newest courtesan,
Tarek says, his smile smoldering with charm.
Join me.
Natasha crosses to his throne and he pulls her into his lap. A servant brings the Raja a flask, and he drinks as he caresses Natasha's hip. Lakia feigns cool detachment, but color builds in her cheeks, and her temples bounce from her clenching jaw. My eyes widen at the lengthening line of courtesans before me. Fewer courtesans are in line than remain kneeling, but there are more than I had expected. One by one, those who wish to challenge me come forward and hand me their declarations. I open them and read their names. Ameya, Kala, Shanti, Manju. After a dozen women, I cannot bear to keep count any longer, and I leave their envelopes unopened in my lap. A tall, curvy young woman stops in front of me and rests a hand on her hip.
You don't look sick.
I'm not. We study each other. She is about my age, and as pretty as a dandelion.
I heard you went to the infirmary after sparring with the kindred.
I doubt I'm the first. The young woman's gaze skips from me to Natasha and back again.
Are you contagious?
My fingers curl over the armrests of my throne. If you're afraid of getting too close to me, you can step out of line.
That won't be necessary.
She flings her declaration into my lap and struts away. I open her envelope. Farisha. I have a feeling that I will need to remember her. Cupping my hands together, I straighten, forcing confidence into my posture.
Before long, Anjali prances to the front of the line, kisses her declaration, and tosses it at me. The envelope hits my leg and tumbles near my feet. Anjali sashays away, and Tarek chuckles. A servant refills the Raja's flask. The Raja tilts up Nitesha's chin and pours spirits down her throat. The back of my mouth scalds with anger. These women are willing to risk their lives to wed Tarek, and he will not sit through their ceremony without a drink in his hand and a woman in his lap. I push to my feet and curl up my hands. The pile of white envelopes in my lap falls, scattering down the steps. Everyone goes silent, and Lakia sits higher in her throne. Tarek sends me a glazed smile.
Has something upset you, love?
I uncurl my hands. I
didn't realize I would have so many challengers.
What does she have to complain about? One courtesan in line mutters. We're on our feet and she sits in a throne.
Ishana shushes them, and the entire line of challengers scowls back at her.
Tarek considers the pile of declarations and frowns.
Yes. There are more challengers than I allotted for.
He must realize that it is ludicrous for so many to fight to the death. I motion at the envelopes.
Do I have to duel them all?
That's how the gods organized the tournament,
Tarek says. But his focus turns inward, and he swirls the tail of Nitesha's braid in his fingers. His chin snaps up decisively.
The Viraji has received more contenders than any other champion. It would be unjust for her to compete more than the others, and I believe the gods would frown upon an excessive trial of her worthiness.
He narrows his gaze at his women of court.
As it is my duty to bestow the mercy of the gods on my people, the Viraji's challengers will draw opponents by lots and battle against each other in pairs. The winner of each battle will then draw lots with the other winners. This will continue on until only 3 challengers remain. The Viraji will then confront the top 3 courtesans in a final match.
Murmurs break out across the hall. I sit again, my joints loosening with shock. Tarek has altered the tournament bylaws. Instead of dueling each opponent, I will have to win 1 battle against 3 contenders. Part of me wants to refuse his help. The Raja is setting me even further apart from his court. But I hold my tongue.
But, Tarek, Lakia says, the Viraji must fight each of her challengers. It is tradition.
Silence seizes the women, and Nitesha turns rigid in Tarek's lap. His tone chills.
Can I not change the rules? Am I not the Raja?
Forgive me, husband. Lakia lowers her gaze, her lashes brushing her reddened cheeks. The Raja shifts his stare to me, and then down to the necklace constricting my throat.
The gods chose Kalinda to be my champion. I will provide her with every advantage she needs to secure her throne.
A storm of nausea roils inside me. I peek down at the necklace, grimacing slightly. Does Tarek see me or Yasmin?
The day after tomorrow, contenders will demonstrate a weaponry skill before an audience of benefactors and peers. Contenders, I expect a magnificent show of prowess. Intimidate your competitors and astonish your spectators.
A show of prowess. What in the gods' names will I do? Resentment hammers through me. I am to fight for my life. Performing for others is the least of my concern.
If anyone else would still like to cast a challenge, do so now.
Tarek waits, his fingers gliding up and down Natasha's thigh. No more contenders step forward. Those who are still in line return to their seats, put off by Tarek's alteration of the rules. He grins at his courtesans, ignorant of their cold expressions and shuddered stares.
"This concludes our ceremony," he says.
There is a beat of silence, and then we all exhale at once. My shoulders drop. I had been holding them near my ears. The base of my skull aches with a tension that runs up behind my eyes. Some women leave, and others dally, chatting in divided groups, the Ranis on one side of the hall and the courtesans on the other. A servant collects the envelopes at the base of my throne, stacking them in a basket. I count 26 in total. I am set to fight only 3, yet the fate of each challenger piles heavily upon my heart. Tarek presses his lips to Natesha's ear, and her head lolls back against him, her eyes dull with drunkenness. While Tarek is preoccupied, I step down from the dais and cross the hall, ignoring the whispers in my wake. I meet up with my guards outside the throne room and release another pent-up breath.
"Are you all right?"
Devon asks. "Get me to my chamber." Outside my room, Devon relieves Manas for the night and stands guard with Yatin. I shut the door and try to remove Tarek's necklace, but my fingers fumble on the latch. Asha is not here. She must think that I am still at the ceremony. I try again to remove the necklace, but the fastener is stuck. I claw at the clasp, scraping my skin. Tarek's hands feel locked around my throat. I throw open the door. "Devon, this necklace, I cannot..." He comes in and stands behind me.
"You've tangled it."
He sweeps my hair aside, and his warm breath slides across my bare neck. I still, remembering long days of riding in the saddle with his body pressed against mine. He frees my hair from the clasp and undoes the fastener. The necklace falls into my waiting hands. I fling the jewelry onto my bed and rub my hot throat. "Thank you," he speaks softly from behind me.
"You did well tonight. No one doubts you have the soul of a Rani."
No one except me. I face him and his gaze touches every part of me at once.
"Do you think I can win?"
"Yes." Devon reaches around me and rearranges my hair to hang down my back.
"You must believe you can, or you have already lost."
His fingers brush my shoulders, sending delicious shivers down my arms. My senses sharpen in anticipation and soak in his nearness. I wish to push him away and to yank him close, to tell him to leave and to ask him to stay forever. My gaze skims the landscape of his face, full lips, smooth cheekbones, midnight eyes. He reaches for my hands, and I thread my fingers in his bigger, rough ones, hard like stone, but so gentle. Devon leans in, and our chests meet, grounding me to him. He smells of sandalwood and leather. I cannot see beyond the brightness of his embrace. My bobbing heart floats to my throat. He lowers his forehead, eyelids growing heavy, and our noses graze. Yatin clears his throat from the doorway.
"Captain."
"Gods!" I yank myself away from Devon and flee to the balcony. I face outside, chest pumping, and brace for Yatin to condemn us.
"Your mother is ready."
"Thank you, Yatin. Please wait at the door."
Devon strolls up behind me and rests his hands on my shoulders.
"Yatin won't tell anyone. He's our friend."
"Yatin may not tell, but what if it had been Manas, or Parisa, or Ishana, or the Raja?" I pull away from Devon and press my palm over my aching sternum. The closer I get to him, the guiltier I feel. I am risking my life, his life, Jaya's life. Devon shoves his hands in his pockets as if he does not trust them to behave.
"My mother wants to meet you, but I will have to sneak you into the courtesan's wing."
"All right. I will not pass up the opportunity to meet his mother." I go to my satchel, hanging on the bedpost. "But before we go, I have something to show you. I found a book on my bed."
"A book?"
"I haven't had the chance to read much of it, but what I have read is disquieting, confusing, Thought-provoking.
Interesting.
I remove Buddha Origins from my satchel and hand it to him.
I've never seen a text like this before,
he says, partly awed, but more so cautious. He flips through the pages.
This says Buddhas are half-gods, and their gifts come from Anu, I say. It also mentions the Jhala, the book the Buddhas think that the Raja stole.
If this text is correct and the Jhala is real, and if the Buddhas believe Raja Tarak has hidden it, perhaps the burner is sneaking around the palace trying to find it.
Devon passes back the book.
I don't care what this says about Buddhas or their damned lost record. Those demons killed my brother.
I glance down at a passage in the open book. Every mortal man and woman was created in the likeness of the gods. Sky in their lungs, land beneath their feet, fire in their soul, and water in their blood. My skin bristles in fear. Fire in their soul.
Devon takes the book and slams it shut.
No one can know you have this, or they will think you are a Buddha sympathizer. Who gave this to you?
Before witnessing Devon's reaction to the book, I was going to tell him that I think the burner left it. But I have no proof beyond a feeling, and suggesting that the burner may be creeping around inside the palace will not please Devon, so I say, I don't know.
I want to show this to Brother Sean, he says. We can trust him to tell us if it's credible. I'll ask him to meet with us. Until then...
Devon takes Buddha Origins to the bookcase by the door and tucks it in among other texts.
That should do it. No one will think to look for it in plain sight.
Then he considers me, his eyes glinting with an idea.
How are you at braiding?
16. I reach the arched doorway to the courtesan's wing and face my guards. My hair swings in a braid down my back, and, per Yatin's recommendation, I have changed into a scarlet sari and smoothed matching rouge on my lips. He and Devon cannot come in with me. Everyone knows them as my guards, and with them I could be recognized.
My mother is waiting for you in the bathhouse,
Devon says.
She's wearing yellow. We will follow you inside in a few minutes. Be on guard. The benefactors are indiscriminate about who they touch.
I swallow a spike of disgust and push through the doors. The courtesan's pavilion is as large as the wives' patio, and opens to the sky. I follow boisterous laughter and clinking chalices through stringy clouds of hookah smoke to the end of the portico. On the dim patio, benefactors and soldiers, their clothes untucked and sloppy, lounge on plush floor cushions and sip from amber decanters. Some men smoke from tall, ceramic-tiled hookah pipes, expelling puffs of clouds into the midnight sky. Oil lamps are lit throughout, breaking up the shadows without disturbing the intimacy. If there is such a thing as intimacy here, half-undressed courtesans loiter among the men, beside them and in their laps. Some courtesans stand off to the side. A man walks up to one and takes her hand. The courtesan goes with him to lie on a floor cushion in the shadows. More men approach the unoccupied women. None of the courtesans refuse a man's summons, and it strikes me that they cannot. They have no say in choosing with whom they share their company. I press a hand over my queasy stomach. Are their souls in jeopardy for being with men other than the one who claimed them? Tarak wishes for them to serve his men of court. Do his orders supersede the god's warning to be faithful? Whom should the courtesans obey? I spot the entrance to the bathhouse on the other side. Unlike at the Tigris Pavilion, the portico does not rim the entire patio. I have to go straight across. Sticking to the shadows, I slip around knee-high tables and lounging couples. A benefactor carrying a wine cask staggers into my path.
Excuse me, I say, chin down.
He slips his hand across my bare lower back.
Where are you going, Apricot?
I grab his wrist and twist. You must have mistaken me for someone else. His eyes scrunch and he grunts. I let him go, and I briskly walk away, right into the back of Anjali and General Gautam's floor cushion. Anjali is nestled up to the general. Neither looks up. I stumble sideways to get around them, and then hustle to the bathhouse entrance. Across the patio, Yatin and Devon enter the pavilion. Devon stares straight at me, and then sees his father with Anjali and frowns. I slip inside the bathhouse, and steam temporarily blinds me. I breathe the steamy air into my pores and blink fast. When my vision clears, I take in tiled ceilings and cool stone floors. A lotus star-shaped fountain dribbles in the concave middle, ringed by wide raised steps. In the corner, a slim woman in a yellow sari reclines on a woven grass bench. Mathura's stately elegance places her just under 40, slightly younger than Lakya. She is lovelier than the kindred. Her kindly countenance lacks Lakya's jealousy. I join Mathura and look over the other bathers.
Don't be concerned with anyone noticing you. They're preoccupied with their own business.
Mathura smokes a handheld pipe and stretches out her legs. Through her gauzy trousers, I see a scar on her right knee. She notices me staring at it.
Lakia challenged me to a tournament duel. The steam helps with the ache, the pipe helps with the memory.
I thought Ronnies only challenge other Ronnies. Mathura puffs on her pipe and exhales a stream of smoke.
The kindred can challenge any courtesan or Ronnie. The Ronnies do not duel to the death, but until first blood or one of them concedes. Otherwise, the Raja would lose too many wives in the tournaments. Lakya has no need to challenge us courtesans, and only does so for sport. Or, in my case, to prove a point. I could have refused, but striking her was too tempting.
Mathura smiles and offers me her pipe. No, thank you. What was Lakya trying to prove?
That she's the best. Yasmin's spirit will always haunt her. Lakya would not have married Tarek if it weren't for her older sister.
I thought the Raja claimed them at the same time.
He did. At Yasmin's request. She would not leave her younger sister behind.
My arms ache for Jaya, and my mind replays our final moments together in the temple. I must return for her. What happened to Yasmin? Mathura glances at a couple coming in.
Not here. Follow me.
Hobbling along on her ruined knee, she leads me out a side door to a hushed corridor. I link my arm through hers to steady her.
Thank you,
she says.
My son did not exaggerate your virtues, Viraji.
If the captain claims I have virtues, then he was exaggerating. She laughs.
I admire your modesty. Humility is the most undervalued godly virtue.
Mathura's mouth tugs downward.
I'm becoming an old crone. Someday Tarek will tire of me and sell me.
He would do that?
On rare occasion, when select courtesans grow old or ill, or an injury interferes with their duties, they can be granted a pension for their years of service and released. More often, we are sold or gifted to less powerful benefactors. But no one else massages Tarek's feet like I do, so he keeps me.
I glance askance at Mathura's arresting face and take in her calming spirit. I doubt that foot massages are the only reason he retains her. We step onto a balcony overlooking Vani. We are so high that the rustle of palm tree leaves in the garden comes from below. The landscape here is desolate in comparison to that of the verdant Alpanas, but where life blooms, the desert's splendor is unmatched.
This is the closest I get to the city.
Mathura rests against the balcony edge and stares at peaks of terracotta roofs under the moonlight.
Tarek took me in when I was your age. Yasmin and I were raised in the same temple. She was 2 years older than me. Lakya was a year older than me.
How did Yasmin die?
In childbirth. Mathura's brow is marked with grief.
After the delivery, there was a misunderstanding. Tarek was told their baby was alive, but when he went to see them, Yasmin and his son were dead. Tarek was inconsolable. He drank to ease his heartache, but that only unlocked his temper. After Yasmin died, he summoned women to his bedchamber and took pleasure in causing them pain.
I cross my arms over my flip-flopping stomach and grip my elbows. Mathura stares out at the city unseeingly.
One day, Tarek gathered his women of court and declared that he was reinstituting the rank tournaments. Many centuries ago, Tarek's ancestor had abolished the tournaments when Ki's sister warriors refused to battle each other. But Tarek took in dozens of wives and forced them into the arena.
My mind struggles to absorb her every word. The sisters had never spoken of a hiatus in tournaments. They led us to believe that rank tournaments were a certainty and had operated continuously since the days of Enlia's 100th Rani.
The women would not fight,
Mathura continues.
So Tarek set archers above to shoot resistors. Those first tournaments were dark days. But tonight, Tarek was the happiest I have seen him since Yasmin was alive.
I touch a finger to my pinched windpipe. Though I have removed Tarek's gift, the spirit of his first Rani's necklace remains corded around my throat. Mathura regards me.
They say your Enlil's 100th Rani reincarnated, and you will be the greatest Rani in all of Tarachand.
I shift away from the railing. People say a lot of foolish things.
Even so, the women of court are watching you.
Tarek has never changed the tournament rules for anyone. His fondness for you will incite jealousy in some and inflame anger in others.
Mathura offers me a sheathed dagger that she had hidden at her side. The robin's egg turquoise handle is the same color as the necklace Tarek gave me.
It was Yasmin's.
Why are you giving it to me?
The second I saw you stand up to Tarek in the declaration ceremony, I knew you were sent by the gods.
I have never seen anyone do that, except for Yasmin.
It seems appropriate that you should have her dagger.
Carry it with you. The tournament isn't so much about what takes place in the arena as what happens in the palace.
Thank you. I slip the sheathed blade against my hip, my fingers trembling.
Will someone try to sabotage me?
Almost certainly.
Mathura looks out over the city.
Not all of us come from temples. Anjali is cocky now, but she was scrounging up gutter scraps in the street when Tarek found her. Life as a courtesan is an improvement for most. Here we have food, shelter, clothes. That's more than we had outside the palace. If it were not for the Ranis, none of us would know life could be any better. This would be as good as any girl could hope for.
Mathura's gaze pulls inward. She and the other courtesans serve the Raja for the same kind of reason that I participated in the claiming. I owe everything to the sisterhood and our benefactors, just as the courtesans owe all to Raja Tarek. I do not understand why the gods have made it so that every woman's lot in life is to owe her security to a man. Maybe if it were otherwise, we would not put up with them. But is silent obedience our divine role? Or has Tarek undermined the very strength the sisterhood was built upon? I cannot discern the gods' will from men's. The layers of truth are too muddled together.
I don't blame my challengers for wanting more, I say.
I would too.
And I do. I want what I have always wanted, freedom to decide my own fate and live in peace.
Do not misunderstand,
Mathura says.
Your contenders do not strive only to better their lives. They fight to show devotion to the gods. Some of them believe Tarek has warped their godly purpose by requiring them to keep company with his men of court. They would rather die for their faith than risk their standing with the gods.
Her explanation clears some of my confusion. Obedience to Tarak is not necessarily obedience to the gods. I exhale shakily. If this is true, the freedom it would give me... Mathura pats my hand in a motherly gesture.
The gods mean for you to be the final Rani, Kalinda. Defend your throne with every breath of your being.
Devon steps out onto the balcony, Yatin a great shadow behind him. They must have followed us from the bathhouse.
Hello, Mother.
Devon kisses Mathura's cheek.
The Viraji has to return now. Where is your cane?
I left it in my chamber.
Yatin will escort you there.
I can walk on my own.
Mathura bats Yatin away, but the bear of a man takes her gently by the arm. She huffs at him, and they shuffle off. Devon passes me a cloak.
We must go. I overheard Anjali asking a guard about a tall woman in red.
I do not know what the penalty is for visiting the courtesan's wing, but since Lakia oversees the wives' discipline, I imagine that the punishment must be dreadful. Will Anjali tell?
Devon helps me into the cloak. We will know before dawn.
17. I am less enthusiastic about taking my morning tonic now that I know that it is poison. But I am in no position to quit. Farisha's questioning reaffirmed that I need to be in top condition. So I swallow my dose and try not to think about what I am putting in my body. Shouts ring out in the corridor. I hide my tonic and jump to my feet, expecting Lakia to charge into my chamber. I spent the night waiting for the consequences of Anjali reporting me, but Lakia has not come. Ronnie's stream past my door, heading toward the main palace. I join Manas in the corridor. What's happening? I ask. One of the Ronnie's rushing by answers over her shoulder.
A Gaeler is being executed in the courtyard!
My gut wobbles with unease. Two more Ronnie's hurry past, bringing along children from the older nursery. Manas clearly yearns to go with them, but he is my only guard on duty. He cannot go unless I do. I do not wish to attend the execution, but the Gaeler could be the same one who killed Manas's family and destroyed his village. If the same tragedy had befallen the Samia Temple, I would desire to face the guilty Buddha. Let me get my headscarf. It's bright out, I say. And, gods alive, I do not want a soul to recognize me and think that I am attending this execution for vindication or amusement. I am going only for Manas's sake. I run alongside him down the main entry stairs and out to the front courtyard. Manas and I follow the flow of women and children around the palace to a smaller courtyard, encircled by lime trees and guarded by imperial soldiers. Within the courtyard are two rock pilings, long and flat like altars. The children who came pick up rocks from a mountainous pile of stones set off to the side and stack them on the rock heap nearest Manas and me. What are they doing? I ask. Manas points to the bottom.
Punishing the demon.
Fingertips peek out from beneath the piling. Revulsion slams my stomach to my feet. I cover my gasp and back away, making out more bits of skin under the rubble.
Who are they?
A soldier stationed nearby answers.
That one is a trembler. He split the desert floor open with a quake and killed a troop of soldiers. The other is an aquifer. She drowned three guards with her heavy reins.
I stare down at the nearly buried fingers as I consider the Buddha powers. Burner and Gaeler, Trembler and Aquifer. Gifts that were bestowed upon four mortals by the demon core. Manas leads me away from the soldier.
This is the punishment for Buddhas and Buddha sympathizers, he says.
A breeze blows toward us from the execution pilings, hitting me with the foul stench of decaying flesh. Clearly, Buddhas are not immortal or omnipotent, but I am shocked to see them killed this way. Why don't they break free? I say.
A Buddha's blood holds its powers. They are bled before they are stoned and die from the weight of the rock before they recover from the bloodletting.
Mana speaks with a gleam in his eye, relishing the Buddha's prolonged suffering.
The Raja keeps a drop of their blood as a token of his triumph over the filthy demons.
I tug my veil over my nose to block the stench of death. My lips tremble on a realization. This could be me. If these people had witnessed what I did to the carriage floor, they would not have waited for me to explain my fevers. Imperial guards haul a half-naked woman forward, dragging her limp legs behind her. They drop her in the center of the courtyard, belly down. Shallow breaths and an odd flicker of her eyelashes are the gaoler's only movements. Her wrists have been slashed, where they let her blood and drained away her powers. The guards pass out stones to waiting participants, adults and children alike. Many of the rocks are stained with dried blood from past stonings. The armed punishers form a circle around the barely moving gaoler. Is it her? I ask Manas, praying that it is not. I want to leave before the first stone is cast. Manas cranes his neck to see the woman's features, but her stringy hair covers most of her face. I cannot tell. He collects a stone and joins the circle of punishers for a closer look. I fall back to the fringe of the courtyard. A guard raises his sword, signaling the first line of executioners to step forward. The participants shuffle in, surrounding the gaoler and blocking my view. The guard lowers his sword in a blur of silver. The people release their rocks. Each thunk crushes my empty chest. The gaoler makes no cry of pain, no plea for help. Anjali joins me on the outskirts near the lime trees, glaring at the gruesome scene. We are both removed from the execution, far enough away not to dirty our hands, but close enough that the brutality will sully us forever. Manas shuffles closer to the front of the line, stone in hand, and a movement from above grabs my attention. Tarek and his advisors watch from a balcony, drinking from gold chalices and congratulating each other on the Buddha's capture. A forceful wind stampedes into the execution yard, grabbing women's veils and knocking off men's turbans. Lime tree branches clap above me. I clutch my headscarf and shield my eyes from the dust-strewn wind. Children bury their faces in their mother's skirts. The sudden gale silences all but the sky's almighty breath. As quickly as it came, the gust vanishes, and a thin voice speaks. We will not relent. Goose flesh ripples up my arms. The gaoler is speaking. She still has power in her drained veins. The punishers back away, and I look at her, partially buried in stone. Anu will curse you. The raspy voice surrounds me, as though it is laced to the air. From above, Tarek's advisors gape at the gaoler's might even while dying. The Raja's smile disappears.
Buddha, it is you who is cursed,
Tarek shouts, his voice carrying half as far as hers.
You are a demon, a soulless child of the void.
You know what we are, Raja Tarek, the gaoler responds. And you will be slain for your lies. Anu sees the darkness in your heart. You cannot hide from the sky. The gaoler's solemn vow freezes my heart. Tarek's face reddens in the morning sun.
Finish her,
he commands, and storms inside. I turn away, but not fast enough to miss the sight of the guards dropping great stones on the gaoler, followed by the grisly crush of bone. And then the bleak silence of a sky without wind song. I flee from the courtyard, down a stone path into the gardens that stretch between the palace and the exterior wall. Manas will not like my leaving him, but he needs time alone as well. From his disheartened glower, I could tell that the gaoler was not the one who killed his family. You cannot hide from the sky. The gaoler's eerie promise chases me. Her death discolors everything, washing the brightly hued oasis to grays. The Gaeler spoke with her powers, yes, but also with an authority that lingers like frost in my bones. She used her final breath to threaten the Raja with revenge, not from her people, but from the gods. I do not know the source of her powers, but to my ears, she did not speak like a soulless demon. A stitch in my side, and the rising morning heat forced me to slow to a walk. I catch my breath and turn down a path shaded by neem trees to escape the sun. The pathway winds to a dead end, and a meticulously maintained stone tomb scored with vines of blooming clematis. I read the plaque. Yasmin, Tarek's beloved first queen. I touch the door of the tomb, still cool from the shade of the massive banyan trees standing as sentinels on either side. The gravel at my feet has been disturbed. Someone has recently gone inside to visit the Rani's remains. I am not tempted to look within. I do not trespass on the dead. Branches rustle behind me. I revolve and gaze down the path where dappled sunshine is breaking through the leafy cover. No one is there, but Mathura's warning of sabotage blares through me. I slip my hand across my lower back, reaching for the dagger tucked along the indent of my spine. A twig snaps nearby. I do not wait to draw my blade. I swivel on my heels and dash into the trees. Urgency pushes me through the thicket. Hopping over mangled tree roots and dodging low branches, I pray that this leads me to the palace faster than the pathway. The trees end. I run out onto a trail and slam into someone. Devon catches my arms.
Kali?
My breaths ring ragged in my ears. I clutch my chest, trying to pull more air inside.
I've been looking for you. Mana said he saw you run into the gardens.
His gaze roves the trees for danger.
What are you doing out here?
I have no proof that I was being followed. All I have is my fear over Mathura's warning. I straighten and recover my breath as I say, I'm all right. Devon's voice roughens.
We haven't found the burner yet. You shouldn't explore the grounds alone.
Alone. The word echoes through me, hollow and desolate. I rest my palm in the center of Devon's chest. I'm sorry I worried you, I say.
I'm glad you're safe, he says.
He lays his big, warm hand over my hand. I want more. I want his hands to cover my whole being. It is a selfish wish, a stolen dream. But I do not step back. I do not let go. My hand slides up to his shoulder. Devon leans down. I can see my name on his lips, ready to ask me to step away. My own lips carry a plea. Cut. I press my mouth to his, sealing my name on his lips. His warmth spreads everywhere, dazzling my mind and aching straight down to my toes. My loneliness and my fears peel from me. His arms come around me, tentatively at first, and then they crush me against his hammering heart. I have never felt freer. I lift my hand to his cheek and stroke his jaw, skimming the thick, soft bristles. He groans, a low rumble in his throat, lighting my senses aflame. He is the sun and the stars in my sky. He is my light. Devon releases me and steps back.
Kali, we risk too much.
I choke on broken words. I should apologize, but it would be insincere. I am sorry for endangering us, but I am not sorry for kissing him.
We need to go back.
Devon starts down the path with brisk strides. I follow, a heartbeat behind, my limbs floating around me. We go inside and reach my chamber door, and Devon faces me.
About what happened in the garden?
Yes? My gaze drops to his lips, longing for their warmth.
Kali, Devon says in a pained whisper. We cannot.
I boost my chin. I can do what I wish.
Not at the expense of your safety. I am asking you to please forget it.
His voice quavers. He is afraid for me. Afraid for himself. If I had any sense, I would be afraid too. I am fearful of many things here at the palace, but Devon is not one of them. Even so, I feel guilty enough that I cannot deny his request. All right. It's better this way, he promises. Looking into his eyes, I see the remembrance of our kiss, and the hurt of him asking me to forget it is too much. I leave him in the doorway. Asha turns to see me come into my bedchamber. She is washing her face in the basin, her veil beside her and her face uncovered. My eyes widen at the red scars on her cheeks. She turns away and tugs on her veil.
Forgive me, Viraji. It's hot today.
You don't have to apologize. Her veil must add to the miserable heat. I want to ask how she got her scars, but she keeps her head bowed, and I do not want to humiliate her further.
Would you please bring my meals here today?
Of course, Viraji.
Asha scurries past me. I let her go, sorry for her embarrassment, and sit on the bed. I run my fingers over my lips. They no longer capture Devon's warmth, but his taste clings to them like spring dew. I drop my hand, a headache burrowing behind my eyes. I cannot face Devon again today, and I am in no mood to be social. Dining in the Tigris Pavilion would draw questions from the Ranis about skill demonstrations. And I have no idea what I would do. I take my sketchbook out of my satchel and draw. The meditative practice of scraping charcoal over parchment eases my headache and helps me think. I must stay composed in the face of my contenders at skill demonstrations. My sparring teacher taught us to maximize our strengths in the ring. Key's sister warriors were each known for having mastered one skill, like Jaya has done with the Haladi. I wish that I had Jaya's ability with a blade. But my weapon of choice is the slingshot, which will not intimidate anyone. Asha brings me a lunch tray. I eat the fruit and leave the rest. She later brings my supper tray, lights the oil lamps, and again departs. In the twilight hour, I sit back and massage my tired hand. The land goddess stares up at me from the page. She stands within her misty jungle. A deadly dragon cobra is slung over her neck and shoulders, and she holds its diamond-shaped black head toward me. A crown of poisonous nightshade surrounds her head like a halo. Her straight, dark hair falls like vines around her strong, feminine shape, both warrior and goddess. I stare into Key's knowing eyes, waiting for her to speak wisdom to my soul. A warm shudder washes over me. I look across the chamber at the decorative bowl of colorful glass orbs near the hearth. Could it work? I clutch my sketchbook to my chest and close my eyes. The remembrance of Devon's full, velvety lips visits me in the dark. Relaxing into my pillow, I invite the memory of his kiss to stay with me through the night. 18. I wake with a start, beads of sweat rolling down my face, thinking that the palace itself is ablaze. First light streams in from the open balcony. My bedchamber is free of smoke and flames. I touch my face and find that I was mistaken. I'm on fire. My satchel hangs on my bedpost. I reach for my tonic vial in the front pocket and notice radiance in my hands. I stumble to the mirror and gape. My face, arms, and chest are glowing. Dizziness grabs the sides of my head and spins me around. I slump forward, resting a hand over the comb on my vanity. The comb's silver prongs curl and warp. I cringe away, my mind flashing back to the burner bending the blade of Natesha's knife. God's virtue, no. I stumble back to my bed and lower myself to the floor. Handling my satchel as little as possible, I dig out a tonic vial. The glass heats in my hand. I pop the cork, and it burns to ash in my palm. My pulse thrashes in my ears. I press the vial to my quivering lips and down the last of the tonic. Panting, I extend my hands in front of me. The radiance slowly fades, and I slump against my bed. Everything I know about myself disintegrates, like the cork did in my hand. No normal person glows or bends silver combs. I press my fists to my stinging eyes and tears slip out. Healer Baca must have known. I bite my teeth down on more tears, my chest swelling with anger. Why did she not tell me? I spent years in a sickbed, yet she never uttered a word. She should have done more than send me here with a formula. She must know what the Raja does to Buddhas. She must know what will happen if I am caught. Shoving away my tears, I stare at the ashes on my palm. Great Anu, what do I do? I have one vial left, enough tonic to last me through the tournament, but then what? I rub my palm clean on my skirt. I cannot do this. I cannot win the tournament and be a... What am I? Demon or half-god? My gaze flies across the chamber to Buddha Origins stashed on the bookshelf. I push myself to my rickety legs and fetch it. Sitting cross-legged before the empty hearth, I start at the beginning of the book and thumb through the pages. The same phrases shout out at me. Half-gods, godly powers, children of Anu. In the middle, the chapters break down Buddha abilities by name. I skim over each power, certain phrases hooking into me. Aquifers possess healing waters. Tremblers hold indomitable strength. Galers hear the secrets of the wind. I pause on the chapter about burners. Burners possess Enlil's mighty fire. Some even share the fire god's golden eyes, though not many. Burners raise the good and the bad, clearing a path for new growth and learning. They are the rarest Buddhas, and their powers are the most crucial to control and contain. In their early years, burners' flare-ups may be mistaken for fevers. Many inaccurately regard burners as sickly, and if overlooked, their abilities will smolder until self-destruction. As such, many die before they reach maturity. I slam the book shut, hands and head shaking. Mistaken for fevers. My gaze rests on my last tonic vial. Their abilities will smolder until self-destruction. At the end of my dosage, my bones feel as though they are on fire. I never considered that they actually were. Questions strike my mind like lightning bolts. I reopen the book and read on, searching for an answer I fear I already know. Devon comes for me not long afterward. My face and hands are washed, and I have hidden the ruined comb under my mattress. Though I am still, my mind churns like the base of a waterfall. "Brother Sean has come to meet with us," Devon says. My strained muscles feel fragile, but I am ready. I drop the book into my satchel, and we set out. The chapel is on the lower floor of the main palace, tucked into a quiet niche. Devon opens the door, and I step inside. Brother Sean is bent over in prayer before the altar, where dried herbs and flowers burn, a sacrifice to the gods. His white hair mimics his light robes, his reedy frame stooped from decades of kneeling in adulation. Devon removes his turban, a sign of respect. His freed, dark hair curls at the nape of his neck. I have not seen him without his turban. I try not to think of his wavy tresses as I kneel on a cushion near Brother Sean. "Let the sky lead me, the land ground me, the fire cleanse me, and the water feed me," I say. Devon kneels on Brother Sean's other side and recites the same prayer of protection.
"Brother Devon," says Brother Sean. "It's a rare man who is suited to kneeling in prayer and hefting a sword."
"Brother Sean, you remember the Viraji?"
"Congratulations on your claiming," says the brother. "Healer Baca and I are old friends. She was a midwife before she became a healer and was working in the palace when we met. She sent a carrier dove with a message that arrived just before you did to inform me of your arrival.
Brother Sean's gaze bounces between Devon and me.
I was intrigued by your message. How may I assist you?
I slide my hand into my satchel and pause. Buddha Origins is not a book I should possess. But I would not be here if Devon did not trust Brother Sean. I hand him the book. His eyes flare open, and he skims his hand over the cover.
Where did you find this?
A burner may have left it for me. Devon straightens in my side vision. Do you recognize the title? I say.
I used to read texts such as this in the temple vestry, says Brother Sean. I thought they had all been destroyed.
He thumbs through the pages, stopping on the drawing of Anu bestowing the Buddhas with his light.
But the truth has a way of shining through the dark.
You once had books like these in the temple?
Devon says, tilting his head.
Why?
Before Brother Sean can answer, I jump to the question foremost in my mind. Are Buddhas half demon or half god?
We are all half demon, half god, says Brother Sean. The demon half being the mortal side that continually errs, and the godly half being the side that strives to improve. In each life we endeavor to raise our standing and become closer to everlasting perfection.
Devon gapes at Brother Sean as though he has lost all sense. But demons don't progress, I say. So what are Buddhas? Brother Sean lays a reverent palm on the book.
In his wisdom, Anu created each mortal in the image of the gods. Sky in our lungs, land beneath our feet, fire in our souls, and water in our blood. When the first four mortals achieved the highest form of reincarnation, Anu gave them dominion over these powers. The first Buddha's divine path was to help mankind achieve balance between their inner elements through the five godly virtues. They were our virtue guards. Mankind has since turned on our chosen guides.
His words resonate through my perplexity. The more I think about it, the more plausible it is that Buddhas received their gifts from Anu. The demon core has dominion over the void, but not over fire, water, land, and air. As the Parijun faith teaches, those are godly realms. Devon touches his temple and closes his eyes.
You're saying Buddhas are good?
Brother Sean nods.
Soon after the death of his first wife, Rajatarak raided the homes of the Buddhas living in Vani and executed them. The Buddhas defended themselves and Tarak retaliated with increased bloodshed. He began to exterminate them in droves, and he removed those around him who opposed the war. He raided the vestry and destroyed all records that exalted Buddhas above man. In a matter of years, centuries of teaching were lost. I was Tarek's private counselor at the time.
Brother Sean's voice quakes, his gaze dull with regret.
I raised him from a boy. Tarek always had headstrong tendencies, but I never thought...
Tarek started the rank tournaments around that same time, I say.
He blamed the gods for Yasmin's death. I warned him that those who persecute Anu's Buddhas will bring down the wrath of a falling sky. He refused to listen, and I was forced to resign.
Devon sits back, thunderstruck.
Why don't you preach these things to the people if they're the truth?
I swore I wouldn't. It was the only way Tarek would spare me.
Devon hangs his head between his knees and runs his hands through his hair. I take the book from Brother Sean. What do you know about the Jale? Did the Raja take it from the Buddhas?
Yes. Buddha powers are passed from parent to child,
he says. I force myself to hold his stare, My lungs wrung of all breath.
The record of their lineage is documented in the Jale. This list is